appellant counsel. Could you introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument?
Certainly, Your Honor. Molly Hamilton Cawley of Messer Lee Kramer on behalf of both appellants.
You want to go ahead and lower the podium? There's a button.
Thank you.
I shouldn't assume that you want to, but since I can
barely
see you.
That is a fair assumption, Your Honor.
You wouldn't be able to see us.
That would be helpful.
Sure. Can I just clarify, are you appearing on behalf of Daniel Kelly, also on ICE?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Kelly, as far as my knowledge, has appeared pro se at all points, and I believe may or may not be in default, but I would refer to trial counsel.
I just wanted to make sure because I didn't think you were. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, we're here today on appeal of a March 9th, 2022 judgment from an order issued by the Honorable Sarah Gruing, 2nd Judicial District. That order, trial order, came from a August 30, 2021 bench trial. In short, respondent is a homeowners association that suffered damages to 20 buildings on its property as a result of a May 3rd, 2015 storm. It had its claim twice denied by American Family. Thereafter, it retained my client's appellants as contractors to technically assist with the claim, and that would be in the fall of 2016, about a year and a half after the storm. And based on appellant's efforts in determining and documenting the scope of the damage and the necessary repairs, respondent was able to recover nearly $600,000 in actual cash value from American Family. Respondent was, however, unable to collect what we is referred to as depreciation value, amongst other things, in our papers, because it did not commence and complete repairs within 2 years of that May 3rd, 2015 storm. Respondents made a $100,000 down payment to appellants, which appellants retained for services rendered after being terminated, their services being terminated in January 2019. At trial, respondents' only remaining claims were for promissory estoppel and unjust enrichment. The district court found appellants liable as to both claims, entered monetary judgment as to each, and we are here today seeking reversal of that judgment, and specifically as to the unjust enrichment claim for further proceedings below to determine the reasonable value of appellant services. I'd like to start with the promissory estoppel claim, and realize the court is familiar with the elements, but it's important in this case to.
Well, the judge didn't address the third element, injustice.
Correct, Your Honor.
And respondents suggest that we can go back in the record and fill in. So tell me, on the unjust enrichment claim, the third element is inequitable for your client to retain it, to retain the payment. And so why is an inequitable and unjust? Are those the same things?
Are you referring to the promissory estoppel or the unjust enrichment?
I'm referring to both.
Okay.
Because the judge did properly make findings with regard to the elements of unjust enrichment.
They did find inequitable conduct as far as unjust enrichment, correct?
And so then my question to you is, respondents suggest that based on that and other things, we can fill in that third element on the promissory estoppel. And why, I would assume you would say we absolutely shouldn't do that. So tell me why not.
Well, yes, and I think the starting point of the analysis is that the injuries that are being addressed in those two counts are different. And also, we have a bench trial, and the findings are governed by Rule 52.01. It has to find the facts specially, that's what it says, and separately have conclusions of law. This court has said in, I believe it's the Bettis v. Fuel Scott case, that where there are disputed facts on the merits and these are challenged at trial, the court cannot actually go and fill in factual findings, and that was absolutely the case here. These were obviously hotly disputed issues at trial, and that would be inappropriate under Rule 52.01 and, as I mentioned, case law interpreting that rule.
Can we remand for the district court to do what it should have done?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, I agree with that. I think in this case there is also a factual element in which I would say remand would not necessarily be appropriate. But if it was just the legal issues, I would agree with the court that you would remand for further findings. Part of what my argument is that
based on the record that was established at trial.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes. I would also just like to add that, as the court is correct, there was the missing element of injustice that was that was just not mentioned at all in the 5-page order, nor is there anything that could be really extrapolated or inferred that there was injustice. There's just very minimal findings and certainly nothing that has to do with public policy or those kinds of considerations that Grueling talks about that would lead you to a finding of injustice. But
were there pretrial or post-trial motions for amended findings? Or
no, there were not, Your Honor. And I think that's a fair question. I think in this case, having not been trial counsel, I will say I think the litigants had finite resources, and based on trial counsel's assessment of the judge's perhaps willingness to do that, proceeded to with this appeal to this error-correcting court.
So then how do we review evidentiary rulings, which you're asking us to do?
I think in this case it's a matter of if they are clearly erroneous, meaning a review of the record to not to reweigh the evidence, certainly, but to see if there was any reasonable evidence in the record to support those findings. I think in this case we don't necessarily have to get to that because of the what I'll respectfully call the deficiencies in as to the legal aspects of both claims.
Well, you won on the contract claim.
The contract,
there was no contract.
The contract was deemed void for lack of a signature, I believe, and conditions, various conditions precedent. So
but
that
then you lost on the equitable claim that followed.
Yes.
So let me ask you this.
Certainly.
With regard to the damages that the other side sought and that you think you should be able to retain money and be paid more because your client did all of this estimating and working with the insurance company to try to get them to pay. And I'm looking at page 7 of the respondent's brief, and it says, they write that you include in your statement of facts a citation that shows a specific number of hours total cost for the work allegedly formed. The citation used to support these facts is to Exhibit 8, which was not part of the record.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so why did you, and how are those facts then supported by the record, the trial record?
Certainly, and I would like to explain that I do note it was in a narrative of what had occurred, a chronology, but I did note that the objection was in fact sustained. I haven't raised any evidentiary issues with that ruling here because there was no post-trial motion re-raising that issue. So, but that is, I think the important point to get to is that was not the only evidence presented at trial as to the value of the services. And I think the district court respectfully was incorrect in saying if there was no billing, there was no invoice, so we can't consider what is effectively a quantum merit argument. And the Dahlmeier case and the Pharisee case that I cite are very clear that you don't need to have something as formal as a billing invoice or a some kind of formalized agreement in order to prove the value of your services. But what we do have here, beyond even assuming that the court found Mr. Stirrup's testimony not credible, we have Exhibit 13, which is 300 pages of emails, diagrams, estimates, measurements, all of the things that fall outside of the public adjusting licensure requirement that was performed. And so the court essentially in the order ignores that entire evidentiary exhibit and saying the only thing we have is Mr. Stirrup's sworn testimony. And that's not accurate. And that is certainly enough documentation and information under Pharisee and Dahlmeier.
The court found that the Townhouse Association paid your client $100,000 as a down payment for construction work to be done. And having just gone through a remodel of our second floor, we don't get bids. And so it seems to me that the court is saying this was just part of trying to figure out what was owed by the insurance company, what should be paid to the Townhouse Association so they could get this work done.
I think there's two points to that, Your Honor, and I think it's really important to look at the court's order as it relates to the unjust enrichment claim, which is the one relating to this $100,000. The court, the inequitable conduct the court found to support the factual inequitable conduct is that there was a person who is not a licensed public adjuster cannot be compensated. What the court then went on to say, though, is it's possible that there was a violation of MnStat 72B.03. So it didn't actually find that my clients violated the public adjusting licensure statute. That's problematic because that's the only factual premise upon which the court found inequitable conduct. They didn't say it's inequitable for them to, the court didn't say it's inequitable for them to retain the $100,000 because it was earmarked as a down payment for construction work. The inequity is inextricably linked to public adjusting, but then we don't have the actual conclusion that the statute was violated. And so there is this essentially a lack of a factual premise for inequity if you don't go so far as to say the public adjusting statute was violated, which is what the court said. It's also problematic on the
No, it just said there's possibly a violation of state law.
The entire context is in the discussion of the public adjusting statute, which is the illegality that, the only theory of illegality that was presented at trial. So I think if you take away the fact that there, if the court essentially says, I'm not finding that they violated the public adjusting statute, and but the inequitable conduct would be if someone was trying to take compensation as a public adjuster without being licensed. So we're left in this sort of void of, well, if they didn't violate it, there's no inequitable conduct. Without inequitable conduct, there's no cognizable unjust enrichment claim. And I think you have to, compounding that issue in the order is the fact that the court does not address at all appellant's theory that what they did fell squarely within the exception in 72.03 2B. So again, if the court said there's possibly a violation, well, that means the flip side of a coin is there possibly was not a violation, which means, again, my client's theory that what we did didn't require a license under the statute, and also as that statute's interpreted in the DOL bulletin that we reference in our brief. So it's a really sort of a, it's an unusual position to take in an order when that fact issue is really material to the entire unjust enrichment claim. Because if my client was not engaged in unlicensed public adjusting, there would be no reason under a quantum merit theory it couldn't seek the reasonable value of those services, which are clearly documented in Exhibit 13. Particularly if the court had actually gotten to the important point of, well, did we fall outside the purview of licensure? And the factual record is replete with information that what we were doing was contractor work. It's not swinging a hammer, but it is all the things that would be permitted to provide technical assistance in the context of a claim being adjusted. The evidence is also undisputed that...
But wasn't that for construction? And he never did any construction. In fact, this company was basically insolvent, wasn't it? He couldn't get supplies. He couldn't get materials. So he was never going to be able to do any of the work that he supposedly did the preparations for. Why isn't that inequitable? I mean, he couldn't carry through on the agreement in any event, could he?
Well, I think I'm going to answer your question in two parts.
Yeah.
Is yes, that was a disputed issue of fact in the court. I don't know that the court squarely came down other than to say he eventually became insolvent and then he was terminated. I'll look at it to make sure I'm saying that correctly. But I think the other component is the district court didn't place, the inequity wasn't based on this was earmarked for construction work, they didn't do construction work, so it would be inequitable for them to retain it. That's not in the order. The order specifically tied the inequity to the public adjusting statute, but then failed to get to the sort of material issue of, well, was it violated? And they said possibly it was. The problem in this particular context is our client had a valid defense that, no, what we did fell outside of the licensure requirement of 72B.03.
Except that the judge found that the defendants promised they would get plaintiff's claim paid in full and do the work for the cost paid by the insurance company minus the deductible.
That's for the, yes, that's under the promissory estoppel claim quest. Correct. But the injury that the court is determined for the promissory estoppel claim is that 2 years passed, so American Family would not pay the $146,000 and change. I don't have the exact number off the top of my head. That is a separate issue than the public adjusting statute upon which the inequity was found, or potential inequity was found on the unjust enrichment claim. So the harm, like I said, the harm is different. So I don't know that you can necessarily take and take one inequity from one claim that has a completely different harm and completely different circumstances and extrapolate it over to the other claim that has a distinct harm, because I think we would be in violation of 52.01 and how the court has interpreted that you can't start filling in blanks for the court on these when it has to specially find facts. And specially find facts means on each of these requisite elements. The other point on the promissory estoppel, and I realize I've gotten a little bit far afield.
You should wrap up. You'll have 5 minutes.
Oh, thank you. On the promissory estoppel, the other issue I just wanted to point out from a misapplication of law is that the court not only didn't even recognize the injustice element, but it also didn't recognize the reasonable reliance and detrimental aspects of the second prong. And I just think that's important because it's another, without getting into the factual record, that's just on its face, we're missing elements, which means respondent wasn't held to its burden of proof. And that's really the only assumption we can draw, especially in an order like this where it's 5 pages and there's no superfluous information in it from which you can do that. So I appreciate the court's time, and I apologize for going over.
No, that's fine. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, may it please the court. My name is Finn Jacobson with Smith Jaden Johnson, appearing on behalf of plaintiff respondent, the Townhomes of Raspberry Ridge Homeowners Association. Your Honors, Signature Select and Charles Stirrup are complicating what is at its core a very simple matter. Their arguments boil down to a disagreement with the trial court's factual findings in an attempt to retry the facts at appeal. This is a straightforward matter. Signature Select and Charles Stirrup swindled the association. The association paid Signature Select $100,000 based on the promise that it would do the construction work at the cost paid by the insurance company. Because Signature Select and Charles Stirrup failed to fulfill that promise, the association is not only out the $100,000 that it paid to them as a down payment for construction work, but they're unable to obtain the $146 and some change $1,000 that otherwise would have been paid by the insurance company. The court heard all of the evidence at trial, and the court made findings of fact supported by that evidence and concluded that Signature Select and Charles Stirrup were liable. Now, they disagree with this outcome, but that is not legal grounds to overturn the court's order, especially considering that the vast majority of the issues raised on appeal have a very high standard for legal review at this court, clear error or abuse of discretion. I do want to discuss the third element of promissory estoppel, as your honors have brought up and opposing counsel discussed in her argument. While the third element was not directly addressed by the court, as your honor did indicate, the court can fill in this third element. The case law is clear that injustice, as it relates to this matter, is a legal question. It's not a fact question. But that legal analysis has to be based on facts found by the finder of fact, in this case, Judge Gruing. Here are the facts that we have that support that legal finding. There was a fact found that the association paid Signature Select $100,000 as a down payment for construction work. The check itself, Your Honors, says contract down payment. It is an undisputed fact found by the finder of fact that that money was paid to repair storm damage. The trial court found that Signature Select was insolvent and could not complete the construction work. The trial court found that Signature Select failed to return that $100,000. And the trial court found that Signature Select and Charles Stirrup's action caused the association to be unable to collect $146,000 in change. I don't know what could be more unjust than that, Your Honors. My clients are a homeowners association. They're made up of a board of directors that are volunteers, and they relied on the promises set forth by these two entities that we'll do this work for the amount paid.
Didn't they also rely, counsel, on the, I can't remember her name, but they had a manager that who testified she had experience with the insurance industry and in navigating these kind of claims also. You know, doesn't that go to, I mean, I know you're addressing the third element, but it seemed to me the findings were weak on the second element of promissory estoppel, and specifically on the issue raised last by your opposing counsel here on whether or not the reliance was reasonable. I mean, they waited a year and a half into a two-year period that would have allowed them to collect the replacement costs to even engage Stirrup. So it seems like, to me, that's problematic that, you know, whether or not Raspberry Ridge's reliance was reasonable, looking at the facts here also.
Yes, Your Honor. Pat Beeland of Advantage Townhome Management was the property manager for the townhomes of Raspberry Ridge. Pat Beeland is not a defendant in this case. The association did not rely on any promises that Ms. Beeland made. The parties to this case are Charles Stirrup and Signature Select as it relates to here, and is and the element or the cause of action of promissory estoppel is based on their promises. As to the reasonableness of their reliance, I believe the court made a finding that this reliance was reasonable. The court specifically said the association credibly testified that it was hiring a contractor to repair damage from the storm. The association, as I said, is made up of volunteers. It is reasonable that they would rely on a contractor who held themselves out as insurance experts, who said, listen, we're going to get this done, we're going to get this resolved, and we're going to do the work, and we're going to promise to do the work at the amount paid by the insurance company. I believe that the findings of fact support it being a reasonable promise, but if not, at worst, Your Honor, I think the correct answer here would be to remand for the trial court for further findings of fact as to that specific issue. The reality is I don't think that's necessary based on the facts we have, but that's the worst case scenario. I do want to go briefly and touch on what opposing counsel talked about with respect to earning the $100,000. And the court correctly pointed out that Exhibit 8 was not part of the record and should not be relied upon in any way, shape, or form by this court.
Exhibit 13, then.
Thank you, Your Honor. Exhibit 13, and I was trying to find this in the trial transcript, but I believe if you look at the trial transcript, Exhibit 13 was not accepted by the court for the truth of the matter asserted. There's a lengthy back and forth between myself, opposing counsel at the time, and Judge Gruing discussing, you know, the hearsay contained therein, the relevance of all of the documentation therein, and I believe it was accepted purely to show that those communications were made and not that they are truthful statements or that they are accurate statements. Regardless, Your Honor, the premise and the argument put forth by Signature Select and Charles Stirrup is that they somehow earned the $100,000 down payment. Now, from a timing perspective, this is illogical because the payment was made to Signature Select in, I believe, early 2017. And it said contract down payment. The record is replete and the findings of fact show that that was a down payment for construction work. Yet Charles Stirrup and Signature Select would have this court believe that no. That payment was because we're going to increase the value of your claim by some undetermined amount in the future. And the value of the services that we're going to provide you for increasing the claim by an unknown amount at an unknown time in the future is exactly $100,000. That's illogical. The timing doesn't make sense.
When was the $100,000 paid in relation to the $600,000 received? I'm just rounding, but by Raspberry Ridge, the cash value.
I don't have the exact dates in front of me, Your Honor, but my understanding is that there was about $200,000 paid, then one by the insurance company to the association. Shortly thereafter, $100,000 of that was paid as a contract down payment for construction work to Signature Select. Subsequent to that, two additional payments, I believe, were made by American Family to the association, which eventually totaled about $600,000.
Mm-hmm. It was November of 16 that the $200,000 was paid, and they paid $100,000 to appellants. And then April 2017, they got $305,000. And then September of 17, they got $47,000.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do also want to address the issue of the public adjusting as it relates to the inequitable promises and the promissory estoppel. Now, opposing counsel and appellants argue that, listen, there was no finding of an unlawful public adjusting, and therefore we can legally earn it. But that's not what the trial court's order says, Your Honor. The trial court's order specifically says, in the conclusory sentence of the section on unjust enrichment, therefore, it would not only be inequitable, but possibly a violation of state law for defendant Stirrup to retain the $100,000. They're not saying it is definitely a violation of state law, or because it might be a violation of state law, it is inequitable. They are saying, based on the prior analysis in all of Section 1 of our order, all of the analysis we did, which included language regarding public adjusting, but also language about you were paid $100,000 for construction work. You didn't do that construction work. You were insolvent. The conclusory sentence says, therefore, it would not only be inequitable, but possibly a violation of state law.
Well, appellants also argue that you brought up that legal theory late in the game and that it was trial by ambush, in essence, with regard to public adjusting, as I read their brief.
Yes, Your Honor. They do argue that it is trial by ambush, but as we pointed out in our response brief, we are under no obligation to provide our legal theories to opposing counsel in advance of trial. We're required to provide all the facts that support our legal theories, and Minnesota is a notice pleading state, so we have to plead the causes of action and the relevant elements, which we did. We said it would be unjust when we pled unjust enrichment and inequitable for the defendants, for Stirrup and Signature Select, to retain this $100,000. During discovery, both written discovery and the deposition of Mr. Stirrup as both the individual and in his corporate representation, we discussed and asked him about public adjusting. The only reason the public adjusting argument was brought up is because in their motions in limine, for the first time, their trial strategy became clear. They said, no, we are earned this money by negotiating the insurance claim. And that was their position. That's, in fact, what Mr. Stirrup testified to at trial. And so we said, okay, if your position is that you've earned this because you public adjusted and increased the value of the claim, that is unlawful. And we knew that might be the case, which is why in written discovery and at depositions, we discussed and asked specifically about this. We are, the appellant would have this court believe that we're not allowed to use the laws of the state of Minnesota in court. That's a bit of a stretch, in my opinion. The reality is we have statutes. We get to apply the statutes to the facts that we discussed, the facts that we brought up, and the facts that were provided in discovery, which is precisely what we did. At the end of the day, Your Honors, the defendants are trying to retry this case based on the facts that they wish the court found. They point to facts and they recite facts as the way they wish the court found them, not as they were. The reality is, while the court's order is not perfect in this matter, the court's order is replete with findings of fact which this court cannot overturn absent a clear error, which did not happen. And all of those findings of fact support the conclusions of law, which is to say the liability of Signature Select and Mr. Stirrup for promissory estoppel and unjust enrichment. The only element that is not clearly articulated, as we've discussed, is the third element of promissory estoppel. That element is a legal question, and the record is replete with findings, or the trial court's order is replete with findings of fact that leads this court to that matter. Again, worst case scenario, this court should remand for further factual findings and clarification of the judge's order, but I do not think that is necessary. I think the order stands on its own and can sustain the court, or can sustain the court's finding of liability. Again, in short, there's no reason to disturb the factual findings, and the court should observe or should affirm the trial court's order. With that, I'll rest on the pleadings. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank Your you. Honors.
Right, rebuttal argument?
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes.
Thank you. The reason that we're here is because the order doesn't stand on its own. The order is deficient. It completely excludes three critical elements of a promissory estoppel claim. Counsel likes to focus on the injustice element and say the court can fill that in. We don't have a single reference to the reasonableness of reliance in this five-page order. We don't have a single reference to detrimental reliance in this entire order, and there is not replete facts in this order. It is bare bones, and I haven't heard any facts that have been cited that actually speak to those elements. And I think this is important because while counsel would like this court to fill in the injustice element as a matter of law, there is case law that says if there's no reasonable reliance, and I believe this is the Norman case I cite in my brief, there can't be injustice. That would exclude the third element in and of itself. And so I don't think this order stands on its own, and that's why we're here. That's a legal issue. That's a misapplication of the law, a misunderstanding of the law, and the failure to hold the party who has the burden of proof to the elements of those claims.
So the judge at the bottom of page 2 found that at the 2016 meeting, your clients promised the board they could resolve the insurance claim and repair the damage done by the storm at the cost paid by the insurance company minus the deductible. And then over on the next page, the judge finds that both Baylander, Boland, and Bruns credibly testified that your client, that they believed that it was hiring a contractor to repair damage from the storm and resolve the insurance claims when they hired and paid your clients. Your clients didn't resolve the insurance claim and didn't do any construction. So how is that not addressing that second, well, the first and second elements?
Well, the injury, the harm that the court has identified is that the two-year statute of limitations ran without anyone performing work. The promise, as articulated by the court, has no temporal component to it. The court didn't find they promised we would do this by May 3rd, 2017. So, again, I don't know how those little snippets of facts actually get to holding my client liable for what the harm was, which is that the 2 years passed. There's no temporal component.
Was the 2 year limit on performance of work or just suing out the claim?
The way the insurance company articulated it was that the work had to have been completed within 2 years. I will admit I don't have the policy in front of me, so I don't want to misstate that, but that is how it has been articulated throughout these proceedings. So respectfully, Your Honor, to answer your question, I don't think those findings of fact can fill in, as counsel says, because there's no temporal component to it,
except that it can be assumed because that they would resolve the insurance claim and repair the damage done by the storm at the cost paid by the insurance company minus the deductible. So when I read that, it seems to me that that's assumed that it would all happen in a time frame during which the insurance company would pay the claim and the work would be done.
And I'm looking at the district court's order again. There's a finding that plaintiff's insurance policy with American Family contains a 2 year limitation to bring suit. That's why I'm confused about the discussion about the work had to be done in 2 years, because the district court described the time limit as a 2 year limit just to bring suit.
Let me find the particular conclusion that I believe answers this question. On page 3, the court said, American Family has not paid plaintiff the $146,349.50 in depreciation because the work was not completed within the 2 year time limit to bring suit. So the harm that the court has found is that the work wasn't completed within 2 years.
But
my client
really
wasn't even. There's many problematic components of this order. I think that is just my time.
So you're not opposed to a remand, and on remand, would the record be reopened, or would we just be remanding to say to the district court, given the record that was established at trial, you need to address the elements of these claims in a way that enables meaningful review?
Yes, I believe that my client should be able to prove. Yes, to your question, the way the district court order played out was that it was a zero-sum game on the unjust enrichment claim, saying because he possibly violated the statute, they're not entitled to any portion of the $100,000 that they still retain. I think that on remand, there should be an opportunity for my client to establish the reasonable value of those services, or on the record, the court would need to consider the reasonable value of those services based on things like Exhibit 13, which I looked at the transcript, page 94. It was admitted, at least for a limited purpose. So it is part of the record. But that, to answer your question, yes, Your Honor, but I would just add that reasonable value of services component would need to be part of perhaps the remand instruction.
Okay.
I appreciate the court's time very much. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. The matter is submitted. Appreciate the briefing and the argument. You'll have a decision within 90 days. We are scheduled.